Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a minute, but we got to get together and kind of get this popping again. The Black Man Talk, we kind of took a small hiatus, but think about it. I'm not sure if we did a show in February. I have to kind of maybe give that some thought. I don't think we got together in the month of February, but we are getting together for the first weekend of, January. We are getting together for the first weekend of February. And part of the reason why we took hiatus, because, let's be honest, there's playoff football going on. And we just had to kind of kick back and watch some extraordinary football. Plus, we had other things I'm sure we're attending to and kind of getting rolling, but we're happy to be back. Myself, Mark Elliott, soon to be joined by Mr. DeMaurice and Mr. Charles. I want to tell you basically what we have been doing here, what we will do this evening. We'll provide some provocative conversation that will give our perspective on life, love, and relationships. We're always going to look for an honest self-evaluation and say some things boldly that just need to be said or spoken. And when you put all that together, we are with Black Men Talk. Now, Mark Elliott, as I stated before, and if you don't know, one of us is in Connecticut, that'd be I. One is in Illinois, and one is in Ohio. It takes some time right now to go out to Illinois and find out what's going on. Mr. DeMaurice, how you feeling, sir?
Hey, man. I'm feeling great. It's cold out here in Chicago. We've been battling snowstorm after snowstorm after snowstorm. But I'm tucked in the house, man. You know, I'm from a tropical people. And I don't like all this snow, but we're dealing with it up here. And I know y'all getting hit hard on the East Coast too, bro.
I'm going to tell you something. Our hitting hard ain't nothing like yours, bro. We had a storm, let's say, about a weekend ago, which they called a storm. I don't really call much of a storm, but they talked about it. It was a lot of wind. But when I went out to go shovel, it wasn't that much to move. But I'm like, all this. And it snowed all day. So it kind of snowed all day. We may have gotten 5 or 6 inches. So compared to what you probably deal in Illinois, we ain't there, bro, and I'm happy for that. Mr. Charles, how you feeling, my brother?
Blessed and highly favored, brother. What's going on?
Yo, man, I'm happy to hear that same one that's in here. Just trying to make, as one Mr. Ray Charles said a year ago, trying to make it do what it do. Make it do what it do. Mr. Charles, you don't mind I ask you, man, because we talked about this before. I know you was working on a project, a book that you was putting together. If you don't mind, we're going to spend some time and find out where you are, what's going on with it, because I know I'm waiting personally for it to come out, because it's going to be extraordinary. So if you want to bring us up to speed, what's happening with it, we're happy to listen, bro.
I appreciate it. Yeah, after talking to DeMaurice, I decided to put that on hold for another year, brother, so I'm not doing it anymore. So I just want to let you know that. Anyway, I'm just
saying
something wrong. Oh, sorry, man. I'm on medication. Anyway, it's been interesting, bro. It's been a challenge, but I had a lot of support. DeMaurice has been huge in this, helping me get through the time when I didn't know what I was going to do. But I've been quite blessed, and actually, I've been able to pass along to DeMaurice, who's my major editor, will be, because I really value his opinion. I passed along a very probably rough first draft to him of the entire book. Was it a couple of weeks ago, D, or something like that?
Yeah, I'm finishing up the last couple of chapters now. Yeah,
we ain't talking about that. Don't worry about that, brother. But yeah, so anyway. but I turned it over to him, and just kind of wait now, because it takes a while for me anyway to know when it's right to release it, even a draft, because you put a lot of work in on it. But I said, you know what, I can't babysit it all the way through for too long. And I turned it over to him, and I'm anxious, and not anxious, but I'm excited to see what he says, and we'll see what we can do. And the hope is, kind of looked at it, perhaps, if not before, maybe we'll think about trying to launch it or publish it maybe around Father's Day. I think that might make a lot of good sense. Hmm. So that's where
we're at. Okay. That sounds good. Sounds good. Mr. DeMaurice, I know you always got something cooking, man. We hadn't had a chance to kind of collaborate throughout the month of January. So bring us up to speed. What's going on with you, sir? What you've been kind of basically in the, let's say, the kitchen kind of mixing up?
I want to piggyback off of Mr. Charles. Man, I've been reading this book, man, and, man, you all are going to be really excited about reading about this man and his father and the relationship. And I thought I knew this brother, man. I really did. I said that to him last Wednesday night. I thought I knew him, man. But some of the things that he's gone through and some of the things that he shares in his book is I think other young men need to read it and other people need to read it. And how his father helped develop him. And we were laughing about, I don't want to give away some of the stuff in the book, we were laughing about some of the things that we had in common as far as when you are kind of like, because I was the only boy in my family, and he was the only child, and how your imagination, how you use your creativity to kind of entertain yourself when you didn't have, like, family members or other people around. And and I was telling I don't know if Mark remembers this, but I remember I used to take get this gum called Juicy Fruit, and you had all these wrappers, and usually you just eat all the gum, put a wad in your mouth, just eat all the gum. And I used to take the papers from there, and I used to write down the numbers of my favorite team, like the Buffalo Bills or the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I used to put myself in the lineup. And usually I would get on punishment and stuff, and I'd be playing on the bed like it was a football field against any team I had. I knew all the numbers of all the teams and the players and all that, from the offensive linemen to the tight end, everybody. And so I would include myself in it. And I remember my dad a long time ago told me that he thought something was wrong with me because I'd be in a room making all these noises and playing and all this stuff. So a long time ago, he said he went to a psychologist to find out whether or not I needed to be committed or something was wrong with me. And the psychologist said, no, this guy is really creative. Let him kind of explore the whole world. But my father told me that when I got older, like, I thought something was really wrong with you because you'd be in the room. You're supposed to be on punishment. You playing with your toys. And it's not like people was other people other than you were in there because you would be impersonating the crowd. And, you know, the commentators and all this other stuff, and you would use all this stuff. So, he made me reminisce about stuff like that. And as far as what I'm working on, I'm still working, trying to do a lot of stuff for the students here and the school. On the creative side, I've been dipping and dabbing on, you know, writing little things, but I've been more focused on Charles's project, trying to get that to him as quickly as possible, trying to do a thorough job and going through it and writing down the notes that, suggestions for the book. So I'm going to put the spotlight on him and get it away from me because I think this is a great project that he's working on. And this project is only part one. I can't wait to what he has in part two of this project.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it, man. But your pops was right, and what he probably should have got a second opinion, because there's something wrong with you, bro. I'm Charles and I can basically verify it. There's definitely something wrong with you. The person that said that you were right, he just went for a second opinion. And also, man, speaking of your pops, man, we're trying to get Pop Maurice to come on and tell his life story, man. That's another great story right there. Last time I communicated with him, he said he was thinking about it, so I gave him a long time to think about it. I definitely want to talk to him shortly after the Cowboys got beat out of the playoffs, so I wanted to kind of get a little bit of space between them, but I'll reach out to him soon. And
bro, talking to him, that's another book, talking to him about his experiences. we often talk about his experience over in the Army and some of the things he goes through now, man, that's another book, bro. I told him he should write it. We need to come up with some ideas about what he's been through, things he's seen, he's experienced. And it'll be a thought-provoking book if he ever does it, and a hilarious book about life lessons book.
It's amazing, man, because I know you and I came up with a grandmother that we went to for wisdom and learned a lot that we still use in our daily lives. And when we think about it, like Mr. Charles, Dad, you know, your pops, you know, when we were coming up, this is where we kind of basically sold our foundation, you know, going to the elders, the elders, listening, basically sometimes they're not even saying anything to us, standing back and learning from. So, yeah, man, to here again, I'm going to lean on them a little bit so if I can get them on, because they have so much enrichment to pass on. And sometimes we don't get a chance to basically sit down and listen because we're so busy doing other things. So, yeah, I look forward to that. Hopefully we'll get a chance to make that happen. Tonight, gentlemen, we're going to talk about the longevity of paper in a different sense, because paper, when we automatically think of paper, you know, we don't think about the stuff that we're writing, and we think about the stuff that we're spending, and that's kind of really going to go to it in a sense, but not necessarily how much and how we're spending it. Maybe some things that we should be doing with it differently. So when I think of that, I think of old black wealth. That's not even a phrase you hear too often, old black wealth. But you do hear the phrase from time to time, old money. But a lot of times when you hear old money, it's not representing us. We think of other folks when you think of old money. But I want to start here for a second, because I was doing a little research, and I came across something I thought that was rather interesting. And I'm not sure if it makes sense or not, but it puzzled me a little bit. And I said, you know, if it puzzled me, let's see if it puzzled anyone else. And it says that money can't buy true love, but it can buy you a longer life. And when I kind of thought about that, I'm like, okay, how does that basically fit? It can't buy you true love, Mr. Charles, but it can buy you a longer life. Would you say that's true or false, sir?
Yeah, I don't know if that's true, bro. I mean, because life is what it is. I don't know what you how you base that, because if it's your time, I don't care how much money you have. Ask, what was that, Jimmy Swaggart, I think it was, Rex Humbert. Somebody tell me they need $1 million or God was going to call them home. I was like, you need to get ready. But, yeah, I'm not sure if I really buy that. You know, it might be something where they say you might be able to ensure that you have a healthier lifestyle, you can eat better or something. But to say that it guarantees that, you might even have less stress. I don't know if I know. I don't know if I would say that's true, because when you say that, I'm looking for a guarantee. And in this life, there are no guarantees except for death and taxes.
So true to them, death and taxes, they come in. Mr. DeMaurice, true or false, money can buy you a longer life?
Wow, I'd like to get that much money to try to investigate that. But, no, I mean, you hear different things about this. You hear more money, more problems. More money, you get more stress. I was reading something about a person who was really wealthy and didn't really know whether or not people really wanted to be around that person or be with that person. Is it because of the money, or is it because, you know, that particular person? And I was talking to my son recently about this, and he was saying how, you know, in relationships, he doesn't know whether or not, because he's a recording artist, and he was like, I don't know whether or not they really like me for me or like me because what I do. And so with the money thing, it's, you know, it can make life easier if you use it wisely and you use it in a way that is healthy and you do some good investments. But I don't know if it's just guaranteed that if you have money, it will you know, create a longer life, because we all have seen like celebrities and people who are well-to-do who don't live long and they have all the money in the world. So, you know, I guess it depends on who has the money, who has the wisdom to use money correctly to do that. But I don't think it's a guarantee that money will, you know, really kind of give you a longer life to live on this earth.
Interesting. Demetrius, you said something I want to kind of piggyback on, man, because your son has been a recording artist. I've seen some videos of your son in Chicago, bro, and he's doing his thing, man. He's doing his thing out there. And I want you, if you don't mind, to kind of tell us what he's doing. But, yeah, he's doing his thing from what I gather. And that's like a year ago, so I'm sure now he's progressed even further. But fill us in, boss.
Yeah. His name, his recording artist name is Wyatt Wydell. That's not his real name. His name is Dakari. But he ran into what a lot of different artists run into. And we talked about this last weekend, signing a contract, getting excited, signing a contract with folks that really don't have his best interest at heart. And so he'll be out of that contract in May. I know he is always in the lab kind of coming up with stuff. But one of the things that was very enlightening that I got from him is that I usually when artists kind of have bad experiences with signing contracts with folks who are trying to get you on record labels, they kind of steal the joy of the artist, where the artist is like, you know what, if this is all the music this is about, I don't want to be a part of it, and it dwarfs your creativity. But one of the things he said that really kind of made me encourage that he's going to come out even better after he's out of this contract is that he said, you know what, they never got my best stuff, Pop. They never got my best stuff, and I think I can do better than what I did before. So he's really kind of resigning the fact that it's a 50-50 deal where the stuff that he came out with them, but he was like, that's not my best, and I know I can do better. And so he's working with different artists who have, I think, was under the same label. They're getting together, doing some things, and what I was really concerned about is whether or not it was going to steal his joy, and it didn't, and his creativity and why he wants to do it and all that. He's still excited about it. He still wants to create. He still is researching and talking. We were talking about different artists that he's, really impressed by, and that he's trying to find his niche in the music business, and he's still trying to find his voice. And so I'm always throwing things at him, saying, hey, you might want to check out this, that, the other. But I was very careful on both of my son and daughter, not trying to hover over them and let them be who they are. And if they need advice or need any kind of assistance or they need someone to talk to, I'm always here. So just giving them that freedom to be who they are and kind of learn life on life terms. And, Pop is always here to support them. So by May, I think, or after May, you'll start seeing him probably tour more, put stuff more on social media. But right now he's in the lab, getting ready for the next chapter.
Extremely good stuff there, boss. Extremely good stuff. Go back to Can Money Buy You a Longer Life. I mean, I would probably go midway with this, a little bit of true, a little bit of false. And I think Mr. Charles touched on some of the factors, meaning that with a higher income, sometimes you tend to kind of eat better. You can be under less stress. And sometimes, and researchers kind of basically lean towards this too, you tend to want to take better care of yourself. Now, how that plays out psychologically, I'm not sure, but I kind of think that kind of plays a part too, because sometimes when you're not making that much, you're not feeling that good about you, and that kind of rubs off into other areas. Northwestern University study states that every time you make another $15,000 by middle age, it basically decreases the risk of death. Now, I can't find much logic in that, but basically that's what they're saying. That the more money you make as you start to move into middle age, the chance of you dying earlier or sooner decreases. This is something that I found to be interesting and never really given this too much thought, but I figure it's something we can talk about. Life expectancy, Mr. DeMaurice, from birth now is basically 79 years. So basically you're being born or we're being born, we're assumed to live with good health to 79. Hearing that, and you're at your current age and we're all at a certain current age, how does that make you feel, sir?
I got to get on the stick and get some things done. I looked at this years ago, and it's increasing. It's increasing because usually folks weren't living past 62, 65. And I know, I was teaching this the other day about, they call it late adulthood, and how the older population, the Gen Xers, folks that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, are living a lot longer than in the past because of medical technology. People are more active. People are eating better. I was talking to a group about my grandmother, and when she had diabetes, and what we know now about diabetes that we didn't know back then. And it was like it was so complicated when somebody was diagnosed with diabetes about what you ate, what you didn't eat. I found out when I was working with a group that you think peas are vegetables that you can eat, but peas are carbohydrates that shoot up your glucose level. So I remember having peas all the time with grandma because she was thinking that was a vegetable that she could eat. But, you know, with the modern technology and more research about the foods and what they really do to you, I often wonder if she had that technology, would that prolong her life? So I think grandma died in I want to say in her 60s, if I'm correct,
mm-hmm.
in her late 60s.
Yes.
So, that 79 is a more of an increase. And then I was also talking about how does that affect Social Security? Because Social Security only lasts for a certain amount of time. So how does that really kind of relate to people living longer, and are we running out of money for people to take care of themselves and to, sustain themselves past 79, maybe 80, even 90, and how, you know, you see some people who are seniors still out there working part-time, things of that sort, to support themselves because this money is not taking them as far as they thought they would when they retired and they had, you know, the pensions and all that other stuff. So I think it's an increase, but I'm looking for the study that says 89, 99. that's where I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, so now it just doesn't seem like enough anymore, bro.
No.
I want to put a jacket on that and get it up a little bit. Mr. Charles, when you hear that current life expectancy is 79, how does it make you feel, sir?
Well, I mean, before I think I probably would have been a little bit more nervous and scared, but I think the older that I get and the older I become, and I think about my parents, and I think about how both my parents pretty much, particularly my mom, passed away at considered a very young age, and my dad wasn't really that old in regards either. In fact, I'm getting very close to the age my dad passed away at. So with that in mind, I mean, you think about that. 79, of course we all want to say we want to live longer. But if it's 79, it wouldn't be horrible, bro, because that's a little bit away from me still. And I think part of it is, what would I be doing at that age? So if I'm living to be 89, my main thing is, would I have a quality of life, right? Because I don't want to be 89 or 86 being sickly, bro. And somebody having to take care of you. If it's a quality, if I have a somewhat quality of life, I don't want to be here just wandering here telling stories and I can't get around. Now, I ain't saying I'm trying to die or nothing, but that quality of life is so key to me because you could do so much more and you feel better and you have a lot more to share than if you hooked up to a machine and they just waiting for you to die. That's not a good quality of life for me. I wouldn't like that.
I want to come back to you, Mr. Charles, because you said you're approaching age where your father passed. Is that something that, as you get closer, how does that resonate, or is this something that resonates in your mind?
Well, it does, but it's like it's weird because I feel some kind of way. I feel it's kind of a double-edged sword, if you will. I look at it and I go, wow, I've already outlived my mom, but I know why that kind of happened because what she was dealing with. She was dealing with a disease they had no cure for at the time. And my father, on the other hand, that always seemed like it was so far away, right? You think about that number. But now that I inch up on it, it's like, okay, let's take in consideration what he passed away from. And when I think about that, I kind of say, well, that I look at it as, am I as healthy or was I healthier than my father was at this age? And he was dealing with a lot of things where he was kind of, you know, dealing with some stuff that destroyed his body. So I think overall, I think I'm healthier. So it doesn't really bother me because from that standpoint, unless something drastic happened, it was my time, I think I'm probably going to outlive my father and probably be healthier. Because when you do things to your body from alcohol to cigarettes and all kind of stuff, man, and just other things in general. Like my dad was a blue collar worker. He wanted to work in a foundry, man. So every day he's going in there probably breathing in black coal dust or whatever the heck was going on in there for years. Every day he went into a foundry with very limited lights and very poor air circulation. So every day he's breathing this stuff in his lungs, and along with the smoking as well. Couldn't do nothing but be worse. So when you think, when I put all that in perspective, because, you know, I'm not really a smoker. You know, I drink periodically. But a lot of things are in my favor for me to be healthier than he was. He just kind of lived his time out. So it doesn't really bother me as much as it did before, because now it's become more of a reality.
I think the 79 in this series that you were saying earlier probably will get lifted, because I think throughout the years, our quality of living has increased. It has improved. And I think the knowledge of eating better and doing better in that sense has helped us to basically live a longer life and maybe be able to push beyond 79. And even with the smoking, as Mr. Charles stated, as society, over the last several years, society has basically frowned on smoking and turned the heat up on smoking to where a lot of smokers have decided to stop. It's not a choice now of a lot of people how it was when it came up when our generation, where smoking was almost like a mandatory thing you felt like you should be doing if you wanted to be cool and kind of blend in. So I think a lot of factors. I know in New York years ago, there was a mayor in New York, this is going back a while, he got it to the point where food was banned. Salt was just banned. You could not basically sell food to folks, fast food, I believe restaurants, and add salt. So, you know, when you first came out with it, it sounds strange, but when you start to think about that, of a period of time where you're buying food and you're changing your taste buds to not always look for that salt taste, salt plays an increasing part in your body as far as high blood pressure. So I think the steps, small or big, that's remained over the years allow us to basically look at that life expectancy and see it go up, and I believe it's going to go even higher past 79. I want to go back to what I was saying earlier about old black wealth and old money. And before I start that, I want to go into something that I came across about a month ago. I was watching a video of this young lady that I tend to, from time to time, check in and see what she's doing. She's very talented, and she's in a polyamorous relationship, but that's not what all she talks about. She picks up on a lot of different things. But it was, she played a video clip of T.D. Jakes talking to Steve Harvey. And I'll be honest, most of the times I see Steve Harvey, and anything I go right past it, I just don't really want to pay attention to him. I have my own personal reasons, but for whatever reason, I avoid Steve Harvey. But her video started out playing these two, the conversation was Steve Harvey basically said he doesn't want to leave. He's feeling funny about leaving 85% of his wealth to his family when he dies. He doesn't think he should have to. He's feeling strange about it. But T.D. Jakes come back and said, you don't have to leave them anything. He said, if you basically passed on knowledge of your legacy, that will be your legacy. You don't owe to leave them anything. You should have to. And that, to me, was like, what the hell are they talking about? And don't get me wrong, I know a lot of black people feel that way. We don't think that, you know, we're entitled to or should be obligated when we pass to leave something on for our kids, family members, whoever the case may be. And I found it strange that these two, we know they're wealthy in their sense, will basically take that stance. Now, I'm going to talk about them both. I think Steve Harvey's trying to say, basically saying that because his new wife doesn't want his old family, whatever, to get anything. And she's in his head. He's not smart enough to realize it. T.D. Jakes, to me, bro, what you basically should be standing for and what you have accumulated, I can't believe that you would utter that, bro, because there's been many people that gave you that last dime to allow you to travel this country and do what you do. So to feel that some of the money that you haven't even basically put labor in to earn, so that you shouldn't pass it on to no one to take it with you. And I kind of believe T.D. Jakes said that because he wanted to, some of you said that, because he wanted to basically appear he was agreeing with Steve Harvey. Sometimes you're in Rome, you do what Romans do. But either way, I think that's the mentality that black people carry. And sometimes you see black folks die, and they ain't got enough money to be buried. They don't have enough money to have a funeral to do anything, and they put up a GoFundMe. And I'm sorry. You know, that's not the time for a GoFundMe, far as I'm concerned. It just isn't. But that's what we have a habit of doing. So if you can't basically be buried properly, what are you leaving behind? What are you leaving behind for your kids, your family? And I think as men, realistically, that's what we all should be working to do, to leave a foundation behind when we're no longer here. And then maybe the time that we was here, our life have not been in vain. And I always remember, Judge Judy, and she said this when Jay Leno was on television. Jay Leno was doing his show at night. You know how long he's been on TV? And he said to her, how long do you want to keep doing this? And she said, I'm going to keep doing this so my grandkids' grandkids don't have to work. There it is. So I know she's a different shade than what we are. But that's the mentality. It doesn't permeate in our community at all. It just doesn't. Top, bottom, middle, whatever you want to do, we don't think about it. It's almost like we don't care for each other enough to think about how we want them to be when we're not here. So I'm going to basically roll with this in a sense. You know, we're more in love with riding around and driving a Mercedes, in a sense, to caring what's going on, what's going to happen when we're not here. So I'll come to you first, Mr. DeMaurice, this question here. And I'm going to put it to black men. I'm going to go with us first because, again, we're the providers. We're the one that step out secure. You know, we're the workers. You know, time has changed and all that. But at the end of the day, we're the one that set the foundation if a foundation is going to be set. So as black men in general, as we basically look around, it would seem like we even think about leaving wealth behind for our offsprings. And maybe we should. Should we or should we not? I know it's a loaded question, man, but I'm going to drop it to you first.
Okay. Yeah, that's the big secret about generational wealth. We don't buy into because the way society is set up and the way our mindsets are set up. So let me drop this on both of you. We all drive cars. You got to have car insurance, right? If you're working, got to have health insurance to go to the doctor, right? It's kind of mandatory to have that insurance in order to pay for some of the things. And if you have an apartment or a house, you got to have some kind of insurance for that, right? How come they don't push life insurance that everybody has to be, it's mandatory that you have life insurance? I'll tell you why. It's because that is the start of generational wealth, that you leave something behind so your family can become wealthier and wealthier as time goes on. And so you'll see a lot of white people do that, where they'll leave stuff for their children. It's called generational wealth that we don't buy into because for every personal reason, or I don't like them, and all they're going to do is take the money and do all this. And this is why they educate their children. They advise their children while they're alive. They coach their children on how you spend your money, how you do this, how you save and all that stuff. Something that we don't do because we don't set up generational wealth. And then we wonder why we're still in poverty. We're still in the same situation we were in years ago. And generation after generation and generation, it seems to get worse and worse and worse. And so there's a reason why they don't give you, they don't make it mandatory for you to get life insurance, because they don't want everybody to be wealthy. It's designed that way. So we think of it as that's one less egg, bell to answer, one less egg to fly, but we're kind of just setting up our future for poverty and heartache and not being able to use resources to mobilize and become more economically empowered as a people, because we don't invest in generational wealth. We just think that, oh, they're going to just take my money. It ain't going to be your money when you're gone. It's over. You can't take it. You can put it in the casket. Just somebody go dig it up and get it. And so if we start thinking of the mindset of generational wealth, that this is something that I got life insurance, I got health insurance, I got all these other insurance policies. Let me set up a life insurance policy so that after I'm gone, the legacy will still be there, whether it's lessons learned or financial wealth, so that my grandchildren, my grandchildren, my great-grands can go to college, go get training, use this money to invest in businesses, use this money and invest in the stocks and all this stuff. Because usually what happens is I've seen some families go into debt trying to bury another family member because the family member hadn't left anything to help bury them with. And so now you're still in the hole. You got to bury this person. You owe money to it. And now you're starting, the whole family kind of starting in the hole, and that's an extra bill. So until we get to the mindset of that a lot of this stuff that we deal with in this world is not personal, it's business, then we're going to be stuck in this negative kind of cycle of not building generational wealth.
That key phrase there, it's not personal, it's business. We got to learn that, bro. We really have to learn it. Because a lot of times we make it personal, we get in our feelings, and we lose sight of the business part of it. Mm-hmm. And in reality, people respect business more than they respect people. Meaning business can make me money. It can do something for me. I'm not interested in you. I'm not interested in what you can do for me. And we get confused in thinking that it should be buddy-buddy, it should be personal. No one cares about you in that sense. You know, it's hard to believe, but in life, people don't really care about you. They care about what you can do for them, what you can do for their business. And that mindset is something that needs to be adopted. I want to go a little deeper, but I want to come to you first, Mr. Charles, because, again, as black men, are we really concerned about leaving behind for our offsprings? And should we be, or, you know, are we? You, Mr. Charles.
I'm not sure if a lot of people are, and I know some people may not think this because maybe they don't have the funds to do so. I do know that is issues with certain people. Normally, you would think you would like to leave your children or offspring or family members something to at least take care of you in regards to making sure that you're buried properly and helping them if possible, but the other part, too, is I think that some of the, particularly with some of our men, they're thinking that, as you mentioned, you just leave the money behind, people just going to blow it. But again, it comes back to the point that was said earlier about educating individuals. And what I would say is if you're going to leave something, but it's to each his own, like I have, if ever something happens to me and I don't have any children, I've made stipulations for certain of our younger family members to receive what I have, and it may not be a lot. But part of it I've added to it is there's some parameters that are added, man. Because when you mentioned about the education and leaving something about building this generational wealth, some of the young people don't know. They're not aware of what they need to do. So you give somebody like, and I don't know, I'm just throwing this out there, you leave somebody like $45,000, and they're not used to having that. How many people are going to go out and just buy a car or buy something that suits them? But if you put parameters on it to help them and to save them for themselves and kind of teach them to do certain things and then maybe have them do some other things and they can make better decisions, then I think that's how you create generational wealth. Because some people, because of their ignorance, no fault of their own, simply are not equipped to deal with that kind of money and make smart decisions because they never had to. Because nobody ever taught you, or there's nobody that started the ball rolling with generational wealth, how are most people going to react? There are some responsible people in your family, but there are a lot of others that just, somebody left me $25,000. I'm going to go out and buy me a car, or whatever it may be. I'm going to go on vacation. So I think it starts with setting parameters and educating some people so they understand what to do with the money when the money is left, or to teach them about how to continue on and create and continue on generational wealth.
I'm going to take this on a little different turn. It may not even be little. It might be a big turn. But I'm going to start by saying this. There's no wealth in puss. And in saying that, I'm going to talk about my grandfather. My grandfather on my father's side. My grandfather worked on the railroad, basically putting ties in the rails for the railroad tracks. But my grandfather amassed in South Carolina, Richmond, South Carolina, a lot of land. When I say a lot of land, I'm saying a lot of land. To a point to where my father telling me a story that, you know, white men would try to come in and muscle in and take his land. And my grandfather, my father, and brother, they wouldn't have it. They tell the story one time a white guy came there and threatened him, and my grandfather kicked his ass and sent him walking back home. And they thought that night the Klan was coming. They set out with their guns and was ready. Never no retaliation. So basically, my grandfather did this. His oldest son went to work for the railroad. And I think that was it. He had other sons, but they didn't follow that particular suit. But they were all happy to have their land within the family. My grandmother passed before I ever was born. So over the years, you know, he kept the land, and they would, you know, one of my aunt, his oldest daughter, built the property, got married, her husband built a house on the land. When I tell you just how big the property, his land was, from my grandfather's house to her house, you had to drive or ride a horse. So much land he had. So over in age, my grandfather would visit when I was younger. And comes up when my grandfather passed. But before he passed, he takes up with a younger woman, not much younger than him, but, you know, considerably much younger with him, younger than him. And I guess you know I'm going with this. So at the time my grandfather passed, basically he's turned everything over the land. My grandfather and grandmother, I'm going to say, had anywhere between 14 kids. 14, somewhere in the teen when it comes down to kids. Most of them were still living when this happened. And my grandfather signed all that land over to her. Again, there's no wealth in pussy. There is none. There's nothing that she did for my grandfather. Okay, how you describe it? Was worth her inheriting all that land that he worked hard for, his kids worked hard to help him maintain, all of that. Only thing my grandfather could have ever done with her, slept with her. My grandfather was able to do that. But he decided to basically make sure when he passed, she had the land. So you can imagine how my father, my uncles, my aunts felt. Just think about that for a second. So I look at that, and I look at basically even my father and his brothers, when they passed, kind of did somewhat of the same thing. So basically, they didn't even kind of really step up and try to do things because they got caught up and pushed themselves. And as black men, it is what it is. There is no wealth in it, but we chase it. We make it the man. It's something we got to have. We're running up and down trying to get it. And half the times we leave what we may have counted, we may have gained to that. So when you talk about generational wealth, there is no wealth in pussy. But we treat it like it is. We hunt for it like it is. We act like, you know, we got to have it and like it is. And there really is nothing. It's a good feeling. But there's no wealth in it. Imagine, and I'm not even thinking of myself with that land, but imagine what I'm saying about my grandfather, if he'd have dispersed some of it out to his kids. What could have been built? What could have been sold? What could have been done? That's generational wealth. That's what it is. But when the top tier of the family decides that there's wealth in pussy, what do you expect the other tiers to do? What are the other branches going to do? What are they thinking about? So I say as black men, we have spent too much time, seriously, chasing women. Yeah. Not understanding if we want wealth, we got to pull up on that because there is no wealth in it. There is none. I don't give a shit how fine she is. There's no wealth in it. And a lot of times we all jump through hoops trying to, there's no wealth in it. And you can't tell me the lady that cared for my grandfather, knowing, please, if I take good care of him, he's going to leave something here. It happens over and over and over again. So sometimes when we, you know, we look at our generational wealth, Do we say this one's incapable because we, as a whole, when I say we, I'm going to speak black men in general, we have failed. We have failed dramatically building a foundation where there should be generational wealth. But we have taught our people to buy Mercedes, ride around in that. There's no wealth in Mercedes. There is none. It's not even a status symbol. When everybody's black and driving, what's the status? What is the status? I don't even understand that. So, like you said earlier, Mr. Maurice, you know, they're doing things, and I never even try to focus on what they're doing, but yes, there are. They're passing it on. There's a man that sat in the White House for 4 years that probably never earned a dime in his life. You know where his money came from? His father. His father. Idiot. But his father was smart enough, whatever he was. You can say his father was X, Y, Z, whatever. He was smart enough to know his son was dumb enough that I can't allow him to go out there and earn a living. I'm going to have to do something to prepare to make sure he's going to be okay.
Mm.
It is what it is. It is. How do you think he got there? Basically, yes. He didn't earn none of that money. That man ran casinos and businesses in the ground long before he got on television and became what he became. The foundation he had came from his father. Money, old money. Where's ours? Where are ours? Do we have any? Do we even think about it? So to me, when we talk about waking up and all that, hey, that's a serious fucking wake up right there. Scrambling through the news on my phone, and I realized that Whoopi said something towards the Jewish people and the Jewish community based on Hitler. And the next day she came into work, it was set upon her in a sense where she got suspended, and she can understand why. And it was so funny because I've heard people say some things and they rally to her support. But I'm going to ask you a question, Mr. DeMaurice. What is Whoopi's last name?
Yeah, that ran across my mind, too. Goldberg. So, yeah, that ran across my mind. And why is she getting this heat? But on another podcast I do on this platform, we talked about that because that was one of the stories that came up. And my thing is that we all really need to educate ourselves about the situation and what she said. What she said wasn't all the way wrong. It's just that you have people that are in power, which I think the Jewish people represent maybe 2% of the United States, but they wield so much power that, especially in industries of music and entertainment and movies, that... they made her do a public apology. And my thing is that, you know, if we're going to do this for the Jewish people, which I'm not going to compare, you know, who was oppressed more, Jewish, African, the Native Americans, all that other stuff, we need to have the same energy for everybody else if we're going to pursue this like they're pursuing her. But I think it's the industry that she's in. And when you're in that industry, let's face it. Jewish people have the entertainment industry bought and sold. It's theirs. And so they determine a lot of stuff that goes out there. And, you know, I think we need to have some conversations about the true history about what happened, what took place, and so that we don't have these missteps. Because they did the same thing to Nick Cannon. And they had him go to a Holocaust museum and all that other stuff. And like I said, I don't want to compare who was oppressed more, all that other stuff. But, yeah, it's something that's really tight when it comes to talking about that particular group of people. And they make it really tight. But my thing is, bring the same energy when you're talking about Africans in the diaspora. Bring the same energy with the Latinx group, Native Americans, any group that's being quote-unquote disrespected. Bring that same energy where everybody is apologetic about what they said and how they're coming out and doing things. Let's do more education, because I think what she was saying was really kind of taken out of context, to be perfectly honest.
I agree with you there, but I'm going back to her. How do you walk around with locks at your last name Goldberg, bro? How? I mean, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, so my point is, so you are walking around thinking they're a friend of yours. You got common bound, you got common interest, you know, and probably part of the reason why you excel to be where you are. And that's why I think that name is stuck on her. She's not stupid, but they showed you, you know, you can act like it, you can be an ally or whatever, but when they believe your mouth is out of place, this is how they're going to treat you.
Mm-hmm.
Your response, Mr. Charles?
No, I agree with that 100%. But I think the confusion is because somebody looks a certain way or they carry them a certain way that they're going to act a certain way. I mean, I look at RG3 when he had locks and they're like, well, he don't act like a regular brother. What the hell does that mean? I mean, just because somebody wears locks and stuff doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to come a certain kind of way. If she's rolling the same way, she might be trying to fool herself how she thinks she's going to act, but that's an appearance. But deep down inside, through her actions and what she's done in the past, even in that industry, she's kind of shown you who she is. And as you mentioned earlier, that's like one of them things, though. You can play the game, but you can't own the team. And that, in a lot of situations where nobody's bigger than the situation, and they've shown that before. So as much as Whoopi Goldberg has done and how many awards she's received and how much control she's had on certain shows, when they felt like she was out of pocket, particularly when it came in connection or whatever related to the Jewish community, they put her back in her place, as we know so many others have been felt that way. So, yeah, I mean, some things never change, bro. Some things never change. I don't care how high you get. They will put you in a certain area with the so-called other folks, right? You have all the money in the world, but when they want to pull back and pull you back, you say, damn, I didn't know I was wearing that. And I don't want to compare this to dogs, but just keeping it 100. I thought I was free and run as much as I could. Then all of a sudden, they pull back that choke chain. You go, oh, shit. I didn't know that. I thought they had removed that. Anyway, that's a Charlesism. You'll get that later on. Listen to it again. You know what I'm talking about.
This is the same lady years ago, which is dating Ted Danson. I don't know if you guys remember this. She showed up to an event wearing blackface, and he was wearing black. And didn't see no harm in it.
Mm-hmm.
So no harm in it, bro. What was the big fuss? So I'm sorry. You know, I laugh at this because you thought you was realistic, because she thought she was one of them. And you're not. You can call yourself Goldberg, Slide, whatever you want. You're not. You're just not. And that's what makes me laugh, because she got a serious, serious smack in her face. Serious. Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles, I'm coming at this one, man. I want to talk about temptation for a little while. Then we're going to jump to these gentlemen's questions. In a sense, we are men. Yeah, we are. and women tend to be somewhat, if not somewhat, a full temptation for us, in a sense. I want to know from you at what point in your life where you found yourself handling that temptation better.
Wow. Let me just say, I thought I had it together. I ran to somebody. He was like, "That's a damn lie." So, I know you didn't really come to us on that last point, but I told D. Maurice, like, you know, something about what we call a mojo, bro. I mean, the best men have been conquered by mojos, bro. They and what I call, I would say more or less, I call kryptonite. So, yeah, something that's but kryptonite, when I describe that as something that you know is no good for you, but you can't stop going after it anyway. You just cannot stop. It's hard. One of my last scenarios, I learned hard because I was so infatuated. I was into what I wanted it to be, and I wanted a certain lifestyle. I mean, you guys have been married. I wanted to be married. I thought this was my person. I thought this was my person. I thought this is who I was going to have kids with. And I was willing to go whatever into whatever I had to do that. But they kept showing me that no matter how much I felt it and whatever was going on, they weren't my person. Until finally it came to the rest. I had to pull back because the just like tasting candy was so good, I had to stop eating the candy and realize that that's what it was. So I would just say probably in the last, how long has it been now? Boom, 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 boom. 3 years. I mean, I thought I had it licked before, but now I have it better. I'm just keeping it 100. It hasn't happened to me all the time, but I ran into something and it had me going. And I saw it, and I was like, okay, I got to put that down. I got to put it down.
That's
and
what
I
we
did,
do here, man. I'm not laughing at what happened.
It is what it is. I mean, you know, like I said. I guess what I'm saying is that kind of caught me by surprise.
It is what it is, bro.
Let me just say this to you, though, bro. Let me clarify this. Many of us say, I'm cool. I got this. I can push that away. But if you be honest, and maybe you have not, but I'm going to tell you, a lot of people I know, I'll probably say, 75% of the men that I know, particularly our men, will say they had that kryptonite at one point in their life or a couple times. They couldn't walk away from it. And some people still can never walk away from it because, as you mentioned about our older gentlemen, some of these women are younger, sometimes 20 years younger or even more, things happen and they don't have the self-control or the willpower or whatever to do that. But all I'm saying is it's more – I guess I'll say it's more prevalent than one may think. And that's what I'll just say. It is more prevalent when we say you want to stand up and go, oh, that's not going to happen to me. I got this willpower. I'm going to stay away from that because that's not good for me. But I'm telling you, bro, I've been out in these streets a while and I've seen a lot of things. And people be honest, there's a lot of people out there recovering from that kryptonite, bro. Or they've been victims of kryptonite. Let me just leave right there.
I'm not surprised at that at all, man. Not surprised. I think the 3 year kind of maybe caught me by surprise. I thought you were gonna say longer, but no, not surprised. Like you said, I said earlier. I mean, that's what it is for a lot. Mr. D. Maurice, I'm gonna toss the question to you, sir.
Okay, I'm gonna start my journey of abstaining and having more real power right now. Today I'm gonna be killing him out.
I love that show, Sarah.
I like Sister Sarah. Which way is up? Oh Lord, I'm so weak. I mean, you had those weak moments that time.
Oh, Mr. Goodnight. Oh, Mr. Goodnight.
Mr. Goodnight, yeah.
Oh,
you do. I think when I started hitting my 40s, that's when I really started to use my willpower more effectively and be wiser about the steps that I made, because I realized that the strength of a man is not always the physical strength. It's the strength of your willpower and the strength of being able to turn away from things that are necessarily not good for you. And like I said, you always have those missteps where you meet a person and, you know, bing bong, you're in bed and what happened to happen. But, yeah, I think in my 40s, I started to kind of realize that I can't let this kind of rule how I kind of behave, what I do, how I'm going to react, how much money I'm spending, how this is going to change my my beliefs and values. You kind of stand on a lot more things because you – I know when I got to 40, I experienced a whole lot of stuff. When I got to 40, I'm like, okay, I've been there, done that, and if it's starting to look like the same thing and it's not going to be good for me, I'm going to, hold back or restrain from this. But it's a daily and weekly and hourly and yearly struggle, man, because, you know, you'll say it, and then all of a sudden, I'm never going to do that again. And all of a sudden, you're sitting there with your eyes open, looking at the ceiling going, damn, I did it. I did it again. And that's part of being human. That's part of being human. But I think over time, you get stronger and stronger, and you realize, I said it on the show, maybe a few months ago, that, you know, okay, if I do this, what are going to be the consequences? Am I going to feel better after I do this or worse for doing this? And, you know, I tend to weigh that a lot more than I have in the past. But yeah, it's a daily struggle, man. It's a daily struggle that I think it, I don't want to equate it because I don't want to take away from like folks who deal with drugs and alcohol. But I think it could get to that point where, you know, you have to keep it on your mind every day that, you know, I deserve more. I deserve better. And this is not good for me. And I don't want to get back into old habits because once you get a little bit of taste of the old habits, you tend to kind of splurge and binge on it for a while until you realize that, you know what, this is not good. So, yeah, it's like when I hit my 40s, and as the years go by, I'm more and more solidified in those decisions that I make that keep me out of trouble.
Yeah. I want to piggyback on something you said, Mr. Charles, and I think it might be, and I'm not saying because yours was 3 years ago, but I think it might have made a difference for myself. I know it made a difference for myself. And it may have made a difference for Mr. Steve Maurice, being that I was married. And basically, you know, for myself, when I was married, I found myself thinking a lot of things through. Okay? Mm-hmm. How did I get here? You know, what am I doing here? You know, what's going to be X, Y, Z? And some of that thought should have been more before I got married.
Yeah. Before, yes.
So, and it may have been some, but I kind of rushed over it, you know, probably, but when you're marrying, you're putting it all and you have time to kind of let it all kind of simmer and settle, it kind of blends in a little bit more. So when you said that, I kind of heard that and I kind of zeroed in on it because after that, my decision-making was like, I'm not saying I wasn't tempted and did some things and whatever. But it came a period of time, and let's just mention, it might have been my late 30s, or early 40s, to where I start thinking about the end game before the beginning of the game, meaning that there have been people that I may have been tempted by, but if I realize if I allow myself to do this, what's going to be the end game? What's going to be afterwards? It could be somebody at work that, hey, they were, you know, things were right, they were right. I'm like, okay, do I want to come to work and deal with this? Do I want to come to work? And if I'm thinking that, I walk away from it because that's where my mental process started going. It's like, okay, what's coming behind it? You know, and you know, I mean, I'm not going to say every time I gave that thought and then say, you know what, I'll try and I'll work on it later. But the majority of times I was able to basically look at that and look at that clearly and go, you know what, this ain't it. it ain't worth it. You know, do you really want to deal with it? And again, sometimes, you know, I made the choice. You know what? I'm just going to go in and do what I want to do. But I do believe, you know, being married and really focusing and thinking helped me to elevate and deal with temptation on a different level. And coming out of it, you know, you come out of it with some things, okay, I'm going to act a certain way. So when you said that, it kind of like rung a bell with me, because I do believe that for me, I'm not sure about you, Mr. Reese, I'll allow you to respond if you want to, sir. But I think that for me kind of helped me deal with some temptation as well. If you want to respond to that, Mr. Reese, feel free to do so.
Oh, most definitely. I, matter of fact, I texted you guys after last weekend, like, man, I dodged a bullet. And so, yeah, it's definitely after you go through that process, you go, okay, I don't want to ever be in this kind of mess again. So I'm thinking everything through. I remember talking to Mr. Charles about, you know, there was a lady that, you know, seemed to be interested. And I think I sent the picture over, and he's like, man, you should such and such and such. And I'm like, you know what, something's just not right. And he was like, you were like, man, you know, such. And I'm like, something's just not right about it. And I don't feel like, you know, I should go gung-ho into it. And that comes with, I think, that experience of being married and going, okay, I got into a spot here. It's a spot I never thought I'd be in. It's a spot I don't want to ever be in again. And so now I got to think all this stuff through before I make a move, because I know what the end game could be if I make a misstep and it's totally wrong. And I don't want to do that again. That's a hard – to me, I know when I was there and I was thinking about, okay, I need to divorce, I need to cut ties, it was a horrible feeling for me. Like, damn, I wasted all this time. I shouldn't have done this. And when people ask me about, you know, me getting a divorce and whose fault it was, I said, no, I take the blame for it, because I never should have agreed to do that. I knew better, and I went into it anyway, and I said, I won't make that decision. God willing, I will not make that decision again. So it's like you really kind of think things through, because I know for me it impacted other people's lives too, and that's kind of like the hurting part of it that I kind of looked at. It wasn't just me. It was just, you know, other people were affected by it too.
Can I throw something in there real quick? Can I interject something?
Please, man. Go on, drop it in.
Yeah, because I mean, I get that when you guys mentioned about it, and I can see what you said, you know, being married helped you there. But let me clarify this for myself anyway. As far as learning about jumping into things, I think I really started to understand that better in my late 30s and maybe or early 40s. And what I mean by that is, I've had a few more than enough times where I could have just jumped and had people that wanted to marry me, right? But because of my experiences as an independent person, as an only child, I was already mentally, for the most part, programmed to not jump into anything, because I was like, I can't let nobody mess up what I'm doing, right? Because if they don't want to follow what I'm doing, the routine, it's going to be worse. But I think this particular situation I was mentioning, though, know, I thought that was it. So I was let my guard down. But primarily, I've been pushing back, and people are like, oh, you're just too finicky, or you're too picky. And I'm like, yeah, you might be right. But I thought this one time was it for me, and I dove into it. But I had the wherewithal, because I really – it was mind games. It's to the point where if you ever asked me to marry you, I would have said yes. And I was like, yeah, well, that's some BS. And I knew what I was thinking. I had to pull back and really go back into myself and really understand what was the best thing for me. But I understand what you guys are saying about the marriage thing, but I also know for myself that I held off even getting married. Because I would ask myself, would it be worth the trouble and the challenge? Because I have to, as far as survival is concerned, there's a certain way to do it for me. A certain way you got to go about it. And if the person that you're with is not going to go accordingly, that's madness to me. I don't know if I can deal with that. And maybe that's why I never got married.
I know I've said on occasion, man, that, you know, you're my hero. We're not getting married, bro. And, you know, we could be taken different ways, but it says a lot, realistically, bro, that you realize was anybody in front of you worth taking that step for, a step with? And I want to ask you a question because I'm sure, you know, like DeMarie said, he basically knew some things or kind of went in. There's some things I thought I kind of went in as well. And I think that was some of the main things that kind of kicked us in the head when we were in, when we were married, because you knew, we knew. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have that, you know, that strength to say, you know what, you know, or we just kind of just say, you know what, I'll deal with it. You know, I'm man, I'll deal with it, whatever it takes. So my question to you, being that you have there been times you felt like maybe I should just go on and do it because I haven't done it, or has that strengthened your resolve not to do it?
I think that strengthened my resolve not to do it. I mean, I could have said, yeah. The only reason why, and DeMaurice has taught me about this, I learned this from DeMaurice even more. I said, well, maybe I should just do it so I can have some kids, right? And I was like, hell no, you can have some kids without getting married. No, if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it. But then I just think I said to myself, no, because you got to, I think part of it, and we all struggle with different things or whatever, but I think you got to know yourself, man. You have to really be honest with yourself, whatever the situation may be. And for me is, I've been on this journey by myself, you know, and the book would show that to people about the way I had to live to survive, man. And as much as I love women, I love Punani and all these other things, I can't have somebody that's going to disrupt the program, right? Because, I'm on a journey. This is survival for me, you know. These are survival skills for me that I learned from my pops. And now you come into the thing, you want to throw it all away. I don't know, really, honestly, I don't know if I know any other way to survive. So you come in messing that up because you got a certain kind of game plan, and I know we're going to fail. I can't do it, and maybe that's to my fault. Why is he saying, maybe I'm still going to just be by myself forever. I just have, anyway, I have a companion. There you go. Wow.
I try not to say much to gentlemen that aren't married or thinking about getting married. I try never be an influencer in either way. I swear I try not to. But I'll just say for anyone, marriage is not to be entered lightly. It's just not. And I think especially when you're older, you should not enter into it lightly. You could almost, you know, get a credit when you're younger for doing it lightly. But when you're older, to me, you enter it lightly, it's just foolish. It's just foolish. And I know a lot of people do it foolishly. And I think that's part of the reason why we see the divorce rate where it is, because they do it for just crazy reasons. But I think as you become older and you evolve, you understand it more, see what's really in front of you. And if you decide to take that leap, it could be your first, second, whatever leap, you really should be ready to dedicate yourself to it and make it work. And make sure the person that you're dedicating yourself to, you know, they're feeling the same way and want to give it back to you. Because anything less than that, I don't think it's gonna come out positive. And I don't think both parties will be happy. And some people can be married for a long period of time and not happy. But for me, I would have to be at a level where I'm gonna be happy and content and want to make that person happy. And if you know, it starts there. So, again, I never tried to be one to influence. And I have guys come to me and ask. I remember when I got divorced, man, he was asking me for advice and how to go. I'm like, look, your situation is your situation. My situation is my situation. Don't look at what I did to propel you to do anything if you're not ready to do it. You know, you have to understand where you are and what you want. You know, may not be, you know, divorce may not be your alley, but it was mine. So, yeah, it's kind of a touchy thing. I know some guys will, you know, tell you off the bat, don't get mad, whatever the case may be. I do understand them saying that. I'm still going to school somebody that way. Listen to Charles. Your question, sir.
Yeah, my question, as DeMaurice talked about this before, do you think, overall, because we know that the young sister, former Miss America, committed suicide. And when I think about mental health and things like that too, Do you think that right now for yourself, you do enough to check on people in regards to your circle about their mental health, or you plan to make changes in that manner?
I don't think I probably, I mean, I think I do okay. I could do better. I could definitely do better. Excuse me. Yeah, I think I could do better. You know, that's an excellent question, man. I think I can. I tend to, you know, kind of feel things out, and I thought, you know, I'm good at that. But, that's a sad story, a real sad story. But, I think overall I could do better. Yeah, I might be able to speak for other people. I think we all should do better. I think we need to start checking on folks and understanding and be more supportive and more considerate. But, I definitely think I can do better. Your response, Mr. DeMaurice?
Yeah, I tend to try to check up on people. I haven't done it as much in the later part of last year and this year as I've done, and especially at the beginning of the pandemic, I would just kind of check on everybody. And so I realized that one of the things that I realized that, you know, sometimes you could be the person that's checking up on everybody, but nobody's checking up on you. And that's where I found myself. Mm. Like, you know, I'm going the whole day and no text message, nothing. And I'm like, wait a minute. Wait, is anybody
in
there? So I do tend to do that, and I got a wide range of folks that I'll usually when they come to mind, that's an indication for me that I need to check on them. I need to talk to them, or I need to outreach to them to see how they're doing, and I'll either call or text message or something like that, or hit them up on the social media. But especially in this pandemic, man, I can honestly understand why people would really kind of, you know, succumb to the pressure of this, man, because being to yourself and you know, wearing a mask. I was telling a buddy of mine, I'm sick of wearing this mask. I know I have to do it, but I'm sick of doing this stuff. It's like it's getting old to me. And I remember earlier this year we had the show in January. It's like, you know, Happy New Year. I'm like, is it a new year, or is it the same old, you know, stuff that we're going through?
Yeah.
So I can
it's
kind
a new
of,
year,
you know,
baby.
Cabin season. Yeah, it's a cabin fever kind of thing. So, yeah, I tend to try to check up on people and say, how you doing? Or when I check on them and say, hey, I'm fine. It's like, no, how you really doing? You know, how you really talk to me? You know, and I did that to a friend Friday night. And, you know, I know she's going through some things. And so we were doing some kind of project together. And then, you know, I said, I meant to ask you while we're doing this, you know, how you doing? And she's like, oh, I'm okay. I'm like, no, how are you really doing? You could talk to me about whatever's going on, because I know you're going through some stuff. And so she was like, you know, I really appreciate that. And, you know, we went into it. But yeah, man, I think it's important that we all kind of look out for each other. But I think sometimes, for me, it looks like the pandemic has brought out the worst in a lot of people and maybe some of the best in others. But I see more of the worst coming out in people than the worst. The best, but I hope that we all kind of look out for each other. And if people come to mind, just send out a text or call them or have some coffee or something to let them know that you care about them and check and see if they're okay.
It's strange for me because I'm not used to having anybody check on me, bro. You know, I've always been one to kind of just go along, and I always kind of felt it was different when somebody was even checking and asking. So, I had to kind of take myself out of that, in a sense, because I realized that they mean good by it. But when you live for a period of time where you're just doing your thing and ain't thinking about nobody checking on you or asking, you know, you're like, okay, you know. So I had to kind of, it was a period of time I had to kind of work myself around that. But, yeah, that's something we all should be doing. Your response, Mr. Charles?
Yeah, I've been trying to do better at that, just checking on people, because, of course, I'm supposed to be – many people that I know have considered me a lone wolf, right? Kind of do my own thing, and I don't need nobody, you know, all that. They're like, well, how he is. But I'm trying to improve, because with this social media and things like that too, some people are just putting things out just because they're to maybe get attention or talking, But then other people are legit when they put their emotions in their heart and their soul and their feelings out there. They're crying out, bro. I've had a couple people I reached out to, and I had no idea what they were going through, and they shared, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's major. And they're like, well, thank you for thinking about me because I've been trying to deal with this on my own, and it's good to know that somebody cares. So I'm trying to be more about that and just stop taking things for granted. Because just because I'm able to handle certain things doesn't mean someone else is not going through it as well and may not be as suited to handle things that are coming down in such a manner.
It's a new year, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yes,
sir. It's a new year, and it's a good new year so
yeah.
far, and I'm sure it's going to get even better. But you're requesting, sir. Come on, man. It's a new year, boss. Step it up. Come on, now.
Yeah, yeah. And I was telling some people, I think I told Mr. Charles this during the show last week, and that's part of my question, is that I was telling people that I get to see my two boys every week, or at least once or twice a week. And I said, probably that kept my sanity more than anything. And I got to laugh and joke and shoot the shit with two of my favorite people in this whole wide world. But the question I had, because you missed the show last week, is this Brian Flores thing. I know you probably watched the show and our opinions, but I wanted to get your opinion. I was waiting for your opinion on this one based on last week and our tug of war with Brian Flores. So give it to me, man.
You know, this one is real interesting because I respect what he's doing and he's bringing it out there. But in reality, I think he's the wrong one to be doing it. It's just my opinion. I think, you know, I like the fact that regardless of what's going to happen, he brought it to the front door of the NFL. He pushed it right up front, and he dropped it off at the doorstep, and they're going to deal with it somehow. I like the fact that it's happened during the time of Super Bowl, is kind of trying to gain some momentum. But at the same time, I look at him, and I go, brah, you know what I mean? You know, it's hard, if I'm being honest, it's hard to kind of look at him and go, okay, you got served the wrong way when you had a chance for 3 years to be a head coach. There's other cats that never had that opportunity. So now that, you know, you was pushed out of a job and, you know, you come out, but I don't know if someone else was doing this and he was working or if he was still in New England, didn't have a job, I don't know if his mouth would be open. But I do find it, what I don't like about it is that a lot of other black coaches and other people, black people, are afraid to talk about it. And the ones that are talking about it, to me, are cooning up about it. They're like, well, he don't stand a chance. It doesn't matter if he doesn't stand a chance, bro. If you bring it out and get attention, that's better than nothing. You know, he's not going to win. Sometimes it's not always about winning. You know, he may be able to push the door enough to where change does happen. But that bothers me. And most of the coons are doing this on television. And sometimes I think they're just speaking what they're telling them basically to say. But I like the fact he chose to. I'm just not sure he's the right person because, you know, you got fired. And you basically, you know, claimed that they had a job offer, gave it to someone else before you got there. Okay, now we all believe that was going on. Why do you say something about that before? And at the same time, this is me. I'll say about Jim Caldwell. Bro, you know they're not hiring you. Why you keep going? And if you thought they already hired this other cat, why are you showing up? Sound alarm right then and there. So it's just I'm hoping the best out of it. I think it's going to have an impact. How big, I'm not sure. But it seems to me he personally kind of just wrapped himself in it. And some of it is because he got fired. But it's kind of hard to think that you got fired and you had a job. And now all of a sudden, you know, it just all of a sudden black coaches aren't getting a fair shot. We've been saying this for a long time. So why aren't you, where were you back then? And that's kind of like my take on it. And I might have kind of changed over a few days, but I'm not sure he's the one should be driving the boat when it comes to this. I'll take any reaction to it. Anybody want to jump a reaction to it, though? That's why I stand with that.
Yeah. You want me to go, DeMaurice? Yeah. I agree with that. I do see what we mentioned on the show. What I mentioned on the show was he comes out because, like you said, something happened, and now he's bringing this to light, which is great. But, again, I come back to that point of how much of a difference this is going to make. And, you know, a lot of the difference lies with the same source. Again, I've always said the African-American players. And we know where they're going to go with that.
Yeah, it is.
But still doesn't mean there's not Flores can't come out and say what he said. Interested to see how it moves and what's next. So, you know, maybe they make some changes to the Rooney Rule and then, okay, they'll look at it all and see what's happening. But the one thing, other quick turn I want to throw in this, DeMaurice, I added this now, is the factor that I want to see how the NFL handles it. And this might be my my conspiracy point, right? But consider Brian Flores is still a candidate for the Texans job, right? So what if they come together as the 32 owners, the Billionaire Boys Club, and talk to the owner and say, look, man, y'all do crazy stuff anyway. Y'all ain't winning anyway. How about y'all hire him so we can get this off the books and let his win-loss record decide whether or not he gets booted again and we can move on?
Let me just say this real quick before we come to DeMaurice. You know, time's starting to wind down. If you notice, the Giants hired a black assistant general manager. I don't know if you two caught that. They went out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just wanted the guy. They went out hired. So, you know, could it be a knee-jerk reaction? Probably so. So even with that, and I said this to someone a day ago, there are more black general managers now in the NFL than there's head coaches. I want to see more black head coaches, but, you know, what Mr. Charles said is correct. Consider black players, because stand up and say something, it's probably never going to happen. Deshaun Watson told them that he wanted a black head coach. He primarily wanted to coach in Kansas City to be a head coach. They didn't go after him, but they did bring in that cat for a year. And my point is, if he can demand that, with everything he's going through, these other players can do the same thing, but we don't speak up for each other. Your response, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yeah, and I encourage folks to check out the show, the first 40, last episode, because I went into this more deeper. Can I hitch my wagon behind Brian Flores? I've been talking about him ever since he became the coach and how he came in and what he did. So you can get that on the sports show. But I absolutely believe what you said is right. This message has been going off, but it seems like every year we're talking about the same thing over and over and over. The Rooney Rule does not work. You know, right message, wrong person. Wrong person to do this because, I'm pretty sure this is going to come out in this track record. And me and my pop were talking about that today. And pop was like, he should have rolled with Kaepernick. he should have rolled with Kaepernick from day one. I said, he didn't. And so my dad was even like, I don't know. I don't really trust this dude. And I think the majority of people I talked to about it, it's like, I remember what this dude did back then. And even Pop was like, he should have rolled with Kaepernick when he had a chance. Now everybody's got, you know, some people are kind of looking at him side-eye, but the talking heads are like, you know, it's like the same conversation. We can tape what they're saying now. Next year, Black Monday will come, coaches being fired, coaches being hired. They'll be saying the same thing over and over again. Go to the show to get more details about how we think it should be fixed. But it comes to the players. If it's 70% of the players, and Roger Goodell said, hey, we wouldn't be the NFL if we didn't have black players, prove him right. Prove him right.
There it is.
If you want to make some changes, prove him right.
Yeah. I agree, man. I've been saying that for years. Gentlemen, appreciate what you two do and what you bring. We'll get together not this come next Sunday because, you know, Super Bowl Sunday, so we'll miss that one. And we'll come back the following week. You all stay strong and do whatever you can. By all means, stay black.